Yeah, so I'm glad Kieran mentioned the word unfocused, because my talk is on, well, as you can see, some challenges in TDDFT and some challenges in TDDFT and some possible solutions in phase space. But the actual sort of the systems I'm mostly motivated by are finite systems, and also sort of strong field processes, and then I jump around a little bit in the talk. So, I understand that most of the talks so far have been more with solids and linear response. So this is a little different, but it is still TDDFT, and I think there's some very fundamental features of the functionals that we'll see, I hope, and I hope you'll still find it interesting, even if it's not solids. So TDDFT, although you probably don't need much reminder, is based on the Runge-Gross theorem, which shows that there's a one-to-one mapping between the density evolving from an initial state, psi naught, which is fixed, and the potential that it's evolving in. And this means that if someone hands you a density coming from an initial state, then you know exactly all properties of the interacting system from this, because the external potential tells you the Hamiltonian, and therefore, in principle, all properties of the system. And so just like, actually, is there a little pointer? So just like we do in the ground state case, you map your system onto a non-interacting one, where you know you have these single particle cone sham orbitals whose sum squared equals the density of the system, and they evolve in a one-body potential, which we break up in three ways: the external potential, the Hartree interaction, and the exchange correlation potential. Everything we don't know. And then one other thing when you're doing real-time dynamics is we actually need an approximation here for this exchange correlation potential. And it depends not just on the density at time t, but also on its history, and also on the initial states of the system, the true state and the Cohn-Sham state. But another ingredient we need in general when we're running real-time dynamics is an approximation for the observable of interest, right? So if we want to look at momentum distributions, we need to know how to extract the momentum distribution of the electronic system from the Cohn-Sham system. And this is, as we'll see shortly, not trivial. So we need sort of two ingredients when we're doing real-time dynamics. And as I was saying, most of the applications are actually in the linear response regime, where instead of VXC, you have FXC, and you start at the ground state, and you just look at the dipole moment, so you don't even have to worry really about this either. And if you were to go shopping for an electronic structure function, I would say electronic structure method, a fair sales tag for TDDFT is that it's achieved an unprecedented balance between accuracy and efficiency for excitations. For example, you may have heard about these calculations earlier, but you know you have you can do spectra of molecules that whose names one can barely pronounce, but you know, a very large number of electrons, and you can't do this quantum mechanically with wave function methods. And of course, you know, the usual approximations fail for certain cases, and I believe that double excitations have come up before during this program. Long-range charge transfer is also a problem for usual functional long-chain polarizabilities are difficult. But there's recent and ongoing progress, which is, you know, leading to improvements for these. But what about beyond linear response? We might like to shine a strong laser field and look at photodissociation of a molecule. We might like to generate high harmonics, high harmonic generation above threshold ionization. We might like to try to target a certain excited state of the electronic system with a certain, you know, optimal field, quantum control. And we can do this in principle using TDDFT. In fact, you can download Octopus, which is a freely available code to run TDDFT calculations. It treats the nuclei as classical point particles and does TDDFT for the electrons, and you can run your own calculations here. But I would put up a warning sign here, because there's several problems here. Some models of dynamics in strong fields show that the usual approximate functionals fail. Also, difficult observable functionals are needed to extract what you want to know from the Cohn-Sham observables, orbitals. I'll come to some examples of this shortly. And moreover, it turns out that there's a time-dependent analog of the ground state static correlation. When you really, really need your, you know, your true system is really fundamentally not describable by one single Slater determinant. This can also happen in the time-dependent case, and even more typically happens, and this can create very severe and unnatural structure in VXC. So I'm going to show you some examples of this. And so here's an outline of my talk. I'll kind of go briefly through some challenges for present-day functionals, sort of a partial overview. But again, I'm going to focus on real-time dynamics, as I was mentioning before. Then I'm going to introduce this phase-based TDDFT, which is a new push that we're making in our group to try to understand functionals better and possibly extend the theory to deal with some of the problems that I just mentioned. And then I'll mention in the space-based TDDFT, we need phase-based correlation functionals, and I'll explain the quasi-classical or semi-classical approach to these. And then for something completely different, this last point here, if I have time, we're going to go back to the Runge-Gross theorem and the von Leuven theorem of the V-representability and have a look at some analyticity requirements here and see how they hold up. Okay, so let me start. So here's a list of problems within linear response, and it's not exhaustive, where the usual functionals don't perform very well. Okay. High-lying Rydberg states, polarizability of long-chain molecules, the optical response of solids, which you guys know much more about than I do, molecular dissociation by pulling H2 molecule apart or lithium hydride apart, long-range charge transfer excitations, conical intersections, which are very important when people are doing coupled electron ion dynamics, double excitations. And for the first lot of these, the first five, one of the main faults in the usual functionals is that they're local or semi-local, and you really need something which is long-range, one of our dependents in FXC. Also, to open up the gap in the solid, you need an imaginary part to FXC. And people have been working on this, and there are a number of different approaches, orbital-dependent functionals, exact exchange and self-interaction corrected ones, time-dependent current DFT has been successful for some of these problems too, and also the nanoquantum kernel, which probably was spoken about a few weeks ago here. Some of these problems, and some other problems too, are haunted by a static correlation in the ground state, where in the ground state problem, you can't really describe the system with one single Slater determinant. And as a result, you find very stark structures in the exchange correlation potential. I'll put some of these up shortly.
Are you going to say any more about the imaginary part of FX?
I wasn't going to. So actually, I can get you a reference. I think actually even in Giovanni's book, there's something about this where he looks at the response, the chi-s equation, and you can show that to shift the gap. But I'll try and get the exact reference. Yeah. Okay, So we've got long range in space, static correlation, but we also have problems here in long range charge transfer and some certain long range charge transfer states and all sort of doubly excited or multiply excited states where actually the adiabatic approximation fails. So the fact that the functional depends not just on the density at time t, but its previous history or in linear response, I guess, more appropriately I should say, the functional FXC has frequency dependence, and this is neglected in almost all the approximations. And this has led to the development of frequency-dependent kernels, which have been tested to some extent for double excitations and also for charge transfer, although not all of these cases need frequency dependence, actually. Okay, but what about beyond linear response? And here, I would change the word poor to questionable, because actually beyond linear response, it's very difficult for more than two or three electrons to actually know what the exact answer is, because you can't run the exact calculation. But
But for calculations where you can, you know, model calculations where you can actually run an exact Schrödinger equation, some strong field dynamics calculations have a problem. And again, it's because of the adiabatic approximation. Turns out that memory dependence is crucial. And again, now instead of FXC, we're looking at the fully fledged VXC. Certain electronic quantum control problems. Here, again, this is an analog of static correlation, so, and also momentum distribution. So these two I'm going to mention in more detail in a few slides. And actually, if I get to it, I'll have an example which illustrates the memory dependence too. Non-sequential double ionization, which is this correlated effect where you shine an intense laser field on an atom and one electron hops up, single ionization, but then because while the laser field is switching direction, it returns to the atom and it knocks out with it another electron, but does it in a correlated way. And it turns out that here, if you want to really measure what the double ionization, you're actually measuring a two-point quantity, right? And so when you're doing this, you can't simply extract it, pair density from the Cohn-Sham system, because the Cohn-Sham system is non-interacting. It gives you the exact density of the system, but not necessarily the pair density. Likewise, momentum distributions have, you know, both these problems, static correlation and the observable problems. And another aspect where you have an observable problem is correlated electron ion dynamics. For example, if one's trying to do surface hopping, here you need non-adiabatic coupling coefficients between the excited states, but you also need to know the hopping coefficients. And these depend on the features to do with the exact wave function, in fact. And so it makes this it makes the parameters that go into these surface hopping calculations somewhat ad hoc when they're extracted simply from wave functions due to the Cohn-Sham system. And again, I say it's questionable because one can run these calculations, we just don't know exactly how well they're doing, right? Okay, so I'm going to spend a bit more time, especially talking about this last slide, the real-time dynamics challenges. And as we mentioned on the first slide, there's two types of ingredients required. The first is the approximation for the exchange correlation potential as a function of the density and the initial states. And the exact one can be shown to depend on not just the density at time t, but also its entire history, and also on the initial state of the true system and the initial Cohn-Sham system. And we dub these effects memory because they depend on the past. And as I was saying, that, you know, mostly people are playing around with adiabatic approximations where you neglect all this memory dependence, and instead you take your instantaneously evolving density and plug it into a ground state approximation. And this is actually the workhorse of linear response TDDFT if you then make this an FXC, right, in the linear response regime. Okay, and there's some difficulties with this. So for strong fields, turns out that memory dependence is often important. As I see later, because I'll have an explicit example where I show you where the exact cases where you can see explicitly that this dependence is very important. But another case, which I'll tell you about now, is that when the true evolving state contains significant mixtures of more than one single slated determinant, the exact exchange correlation potential develops unnatural structures, which are quite difficult to model. And this is the time-dependent analog of static correlation. So for this, put up a slide here which illustrates this problem, and I think Kieran may have spoken about this last week as well. So some quantum control problems. Say if we consider pumping helium from its 1s2, the ground state, to its first accessible excited state, which is a single excitation to the 2p state. And if you try to do this with Cohn-Sham, you immediately have a problem, because in Cohn-Sham, you put in your orbital and into your Cohn-Sham equation and evolve it, right? But you're starting with 1 phi 1s orbital, and you're not going to make up another orbital on the way, right? It will evolve in time, but you'll always have one orbital to describe your Cohn-Sham system, one doubly occupied orbital. So, to show how weird this might look, consider here, instead of the helium, just a harmonic well, and we're trying to target, we're starting from phi zero here, doubly occupied, and we're trying to target the density, we're trying to find the control field that will excite us to this density, which is the target density of the singly excited state, one orbital, one electron hopping up to this orbital. Now, if you manage to do the Cohn-Sham, an exact Cohn-Sham calculation with an exact VXC, then actually you can get this exact density if that's the target. The problem is, you're getting it with this strange doubly occupied orbital, right? You square this and you get this. And this doubly occupied orbital, this state looks nothing like this state, right? If you're interested only in the density, then it doesn't matter, right? We've got the exact density with this funny VXC. But the problem is, one might want to know what the momentum distribution is, or angular momentum, or other aspects of the state. And because this is so different, you'll get things which are completely, you know, completely unphysical or wrong. And in fact, you can see that the Cohn-Sham exact exchange correlation potential, in order to get this density using this W occupied orbital, has this funny bump in between, sort of a barrier which sort of pushes away the density from the middle. And it doesn't really look at all like anything that the potential is supposed to look like at the end of the pumping. And so this is a difficulty, right? It's very difficult to approximate this, and the state is wrong, right?
So here
there are no nodes. So the density is always positive here. So therefore the square root of it is always positive, and therefore it has no nodes. And therefore it's the ground state. Okay.
So that's specific to?
Yes, for specific to this example. Yeah, right. Yeah. So in general, that's true. It won't necessarily be. Right. Okay. So this difficulty is caused by the inability of the Cohn-Sham system to change occupation numbers, right? The number of orbitals you start with is the number of orbitals you have always. One single slated determinant forever, right? Which is really very nice, because that's why we can have this favorable scaling with the system size, but then it creates these difficulties, right? So this is the time-dependent analog of static correlation, which also haunts ground state DFT. And I'll just mention very briefly a sort of a very dramatic example of static correlation in the ground state, which is molecular dissociation in heterotomics. So for example here, oops, I didn't mention this. Oh, yes, I did, sort of. This is a model of lithium hydride, and we're pulling it apart, you know, so it's dissociating. And if you look at VXC or VHXC asymptotically, you might think, this is a 1D, one electron lithium, one electron hydrogen model, right? So we've just shifted the ionization potentials here. But you can see that actually what's happening is you have the step that develops. Instead of actually finding something just constant, you have a step that develops, which is absolutely essential to get fractional charge transfer, to prevent the fractional charge transfer. But you also have a peak in the middle, a very sharp peak here. And this is sort of a kinetic effect. And the point is that these structures appear in very relatively low density regions, right? The density is very low and between these dissociating atoms. For ground state, apart from the, for the ground state problem, energetically, it doesn't really affect the system very much. But when you're doing response and excitations, they have a dramatic effect. For example, this can act as a barrier in transport, the peak can. And the step, it turns out that it realigns the HOMOs on each system, and it introduces a static correlation to the Cohn-Sham system that has to somehow be undone when you then try to get the true excitations of lithium hydride where you don't have this degeneracy. So that's described in some of these works here. Okay, so this is some problems with the usual approximations for VXC. But we also need an approximation for the observable functionals, remember, from the first slide. So we need to extract the property that we're interested in from the Cohn-Sham system. And sometimes this is simple. For example, if we want to know high harmonic generation, if we want to calculate that, well, it's just a measure of the dipole moment. But the dipole moment is just the integral of the density times r, or z, or whatever it is. And so therefore, it's directly related to the density. And since the Cohn-Sham system gives you the right density, then there's no extra functional that's needed. We can extract it exactly. But often it's not so simple. So for example, if you want to know double ionization probabilities, the probability that two electrons have left your molecule, right? Then you need to have, you really need a two-point kind of quantity. You need the pair density. And if you use, so then you need to know, well, how do you extract that from the Cohn-Sham system? And if you just simply use an expression for the pair density, which is applied for non-interacting systems, you don't get the correct knee in the double ionization graph, for example. And in fact, Wilken and Bauer have this nice paper recently which showed that they introduced a correlated approximation for this pair density functional as a function of the density that actually did improve the situation a lot for this observable. But other things we might be interested in, kinetic energies. Kinetic energy of the Cohn-Sham system is not the same as the kinetic energy of the true system. It can be extracted from it, but we don't know how to, right? Or recoil ion momentum distributions. Now, let me mention this a little bit. So again, this problem of non-sequential double ionization. So this in particular was a calculation of a 1D helium atom. You shine a very strong laser field on it, and you calculate double ionization, single ionization yields. And as I was mentioning, progress has been made for approximations in TDDFT to get these accurate yields and capture this knee. But what about momentum distributions? In fact, Wilken and Bauer also studied this. You might, experimentally, you can measure, once the electrons have left, how much is the ion recoiling, and then relate that to the electron distribution. So if you want to predict that from a Cohn-Sham calculation, you might think, well, let's calculate the Cohn-Sham momentum distributions. And that's what they did in this model system here. They calculated the Cohn-Sham momentum distributions and compared them to the exact momentum distributions calculated from an exact solution to Schrödinger's equation. And this is what they found. This is the exact solution here in gray. And it has this double hump structure, which is apparently characteristic for these processes. Here, however, is the momentum distribution computed from the Cohn-Sham orbitals, just the momentum of each orbital, right? And you can see that it misses the double hump structure, and moreover, it overestimates the probability by a factor of 4 here, the momentum the density. So in fact, it does a very poor job. So generally, time-dependent Cohn-Sham momentum distributions really don't have anything to do with a true momentum distribution. And in principle, the true momentum distribution is a function of the Cohn-Sham system, but what functional? We don't know that. I wanted to look at this in a little bit more detail, and so to study a very, very simple model of ionization, and try and understand, at least in this case, where the problem is coming from. Here is a system where we have this electron here, which is dispersing away from an electron here. They both started out here. And this electron is ionizing, it's just evolving away in free particle dispersion. Okay, so it's moving away. And if you look at the Cohn-Sham and the true densities by construction, they're the same, right? Now let's look at the momentum distributions. What we find for the true system is shown here in red, and it's what we might expect. This electron's not moving, so you have a bump at zero. And this electron here is moving away with momentum p0, so you have a momentum, you have a peak at p0, and then there's some, you know, there's some width to the distribution, so there's some width in momentum space, right? So again, what we did, we just took the wave function in coordinate space, Fourier transformed it to momentum space, and figured out the momentum, one-body momentum distribution. So now let's do this for the Cohn-Sham system. Even though it has the same density, it doesn't have the same wave function. It's a single-slated determinant. And when you do this, you get the envelope kind of right, but then you have all these wiggles, these oscillations, quite strong in the momentum distribution of the Cohn-Sham system. To understand this further, we thought we would look in phase space. In other words, we thought, well, let's look at a joint probability distribution, coordinate and momentum. So this is like a Wigner phase space distribution, and I'll define these carefully later, shortly. But for now, just think of it, you probably have come across Wigner densities before, but if not, just think about it's kind of like a quantum mechanical quasi-probability of getting a joint probability distribution in phase space, right? Yes.
Say a little more about what the many-body wave function is.
Yeah, sure, sorry. Okay, so the many-body wave function, so is one electron sitting here. It's one electron moving away. So actually, I could write it. So it's two electrons, and I guess I could write it like this. Thanks. As phi 0, r1, and let's write it as phi p, r2. Plus phi p r2 phi 0. So it's kind of like a Hartle-London type form, but then the time dependent, you can put time here everywhere. Yeah. And so these things, so phi 0 is actually time independent, and phi p is a free particle Gaussian. So it's just, free particle dispersing Gaussian. So you just have a Gaussian and then you let it evolve in free space. It's not relevant here, I guess, right? So because there may be potential, but actually here I'm assuming there's no potential. Well, how should I say this? This is just a model system where I'm saying if this is my true state, then what is the Cohn-Sham state? And so the Cohn-Sham state is going to be this at t, which is phi z. You know, it has to, because we're started. Let me call it phi. I guess I'll call it phi Cohn-Sham, where this is the square root of the density. So it's kind of like, you know, with any true wave function, you just find the density and then square root it. And this is, I should be more careful. There's also a phase here, which is the integral of j over n dx, right? So this just comes from the continuity equation. But if one does this carefully, then. So it's kind of some arbitrary wave function, which is sort of describing ionization. I mean, that's not really, but, you know, it's just that it's for the purposes of the demonstration, I think it's okay.
You assume it's feverish in the middle, right?
Yeah, right. So I should assume it's feverish in the middle. But I guess in this case, if you want, you could say, well, let's assume zero potential, and we start off in the subset. So, yeah, I don't want to go there. yet. Although, actually, in the last part of the talk, I'll discuss some problems there. Anyway, okay. So now I'm going to look at this Wigner function, which I'll define shortly. But it's basically a joint probability in position momentum space. So here's position, here's momentum, and you have for the true wave function, right? One electron sitting here, one electron dispersing away. Just what you might expect. A blob sitting at x equals 0, p equals 0, and then a blob which is moving away at some x and p 0, right? So very, very classical distribution, right? Two sort of classical electrons right here, if you like. If instead we take this funny Cohn-Sham wave function, which is a doubly occupied orbital, which has this density, you get a very different wave quasi-probability distribution. You get something kind of trying to be sitting here, but then you have these very fast oscillations. Moreover, you get negative regions in the phase space distribution. Yeah.
Could you just write down what your definition of the
graph? Yeah. Yeah. Sure. So I have it later. So you take, actually you take the density matrix for this two electron case. So actually, these Wigner functions, and I'm going to spend much more time on them shortly, they're used a lot in sort of quantum optics, often mostly for one-particle systems. But basically, you sort of displace, you look off diagonal for the density matrix and Fourier transform it in momentum. And the thing is, this has some very nice features, because it turns out that if you integrate this over position, you get the true momentum distribution of the quantum wave function. And if you integrate it over momentum, you get the true position coordinate density. So I'll come to that shortly.
Can you get back to the density matrix from the ball?
Yes, yes. Yeah, this is invertible. It's a one-to-one. Yeah, so actually, well, I'll come to that. Yeah, yeah. So I'll spend much more time on this shortly. Okay, but for now to note, so look how, you know, this is so crazily different, right? The coordinate densities are the same. The momentum distributions are kind of the same, but not really. And the Wigner phase space distributions are dramatically different. The exact one is very classical. And the true one, the Cohn-Sham one, and again, this is the exact Cohn-Sham, right? Because the exact density is reproduced by the non-directed system, is very non-classical. And we can understand why it's non-classical. And this is, again, related to the static correlation problem. The fact that we are describing this very delocalized system of two electrons with one orbital, right? Both electrons are in the same orbital and it's very delocalized. It's the square root, essentially, of this density plus some phases. And because it's non-classical, because this is the in Wigner functions, probability distributions, negative regions indicate non-classical behavior, and we can understand very much why. It has to be delocalized here in order to get the density correct. Okay, so Cohn-Sham is describing an essentially classical situation non-classically. And this is typical, this is going to happen typically for ionization systems, for ionization problems, I think. At least for two electrons, maybe I shouldn't say typically. So maybe, you know, for an even number of electrons, right? Yeah.
Can you explain, or do you know what the wavelength of those oscillations
are? That's a good question. I haven't really looked into it. I think it's partly to do with the overlap of the momentum, the true momentum distributions, how far the zero and the P zero are. Turns out that if we made P zero very large and the overlap decreased, then these oscillations would die out. But then you would still have them in the Wigner distribution. Actually, that's an even more interesting graph, but my PhD student, he has the graphs and I didn't get them from him, but I should have put that one up, because it's actually more interesting, because there, so in other words, actually, one thing we looked at was one, the electrons moving away from each other. So one electron here moving with P0 that way, one electron moving with minus P0 that way. And there, we found that, of course, the coordinate density is reproduced exactly by Cohn-Sham by definition. We also found the momentum distribution is almost the same. But if we looked in phase space, we again got these oscillations in the midpoint region.
Could it not be argued that the Wigner distribution, when you look on a small length scale, as you are doing here, is always going to be non-classical? And indeed, it only looks classical on the left because you happen to choose a very simple, smooth initial wave function that had a positive, most unusually, a positive Fourier transform.
Oh, I see. Okay, right. No, I think that certainly is true. I guess I still think that we can. So usually when you get these negative regions, right? So even if we have, so usually when you get these negative regions, you have some very delocalized behavior, either in position or momentum happening. And so I guess I'm saying that. You can get cases where the true system is behaving more or less classically and the Cohn-Sham is not. But I think you're right. In general, you will. But then in general also you'll have, even if this will look less classical, this will look even more crazily non-classical, I think. Right? Yeah.
Yes? You mentioned briefly that in the asymptotic region, when you pull them very far apart.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So actually I should get the graphs out there. But I don't think I have them on the laptop here. So we looked at this situation. So you have P0 and minus P0, and this is the density and say n of x at some time t. And then what you find, if you look at the momentum distributions, and so we're now plotting and momentum, you find that the Cohn-Sham and the true are very close. There's a little difference here, but it's hardly discernible on the scale of the thing. The momentum distributions are very similar, but then again, if you look at the Wigner distributions, again, you get a classical type picture. As Rex points out, everything's very nice and smooth, so everything looks very classical here. I can't draw it in two dimensions. It looks nice and classical here, but then in the mid region, there are these fast, quite rapid, and quite large oscillations in the middle region. and between them. And so then, you know, if you take an integral or slice through coordinate space, they're not there. They're hardly there in momentum space, but they are there in the phase space distribution. So it tells us quite a lot.
I guess I didn't name it correctly. If you take your wave function, but you, instead of these, you made these two wave packets starting from very far apart in the first place. Just this example.
Okay, yeah.
You made the second, the moving one. But much, much farther away from.
Oh, I see. Okay.
What happened to the right hand side? What happened to the oscillation?
Yeah. So there. So we keep the situation you're saying, but we look at a later time, or you make the P0 larger, so it disperses faster, or whatever, right? Yeah. Then it's similar to this. The momentum distributions are similar, right? The oscillations get less in the momentum distribution, but then if you look in phase space, you still have these rapid oscillations in the small density region. So if you know they integrate out to zero in any slice, right? X slice or P slice, but if you look at the joint probability distribution, they're still there.
I'm just curious about the period of this oscillation.
Yeah.
See whether there is any length scale that defines this oscillation.
Right. No, that's a good question, like Karen's question. I haven't looked into that. There must be, right? Something.
They have to correspond to some length scale and also some.
Right. The oscillation in the in this, and that's probably I'm sure there must be. I mean. Yeah, maybe one can even see it from just staring at this equation somehow, but I'm not sure. I can't answer that now.
Three length scale in this problem, right? The difference between them in distance
and position.
Width of left. And the
yes.
Path. So three scale, right?
Right, and the momentum distribution.
Bound to give you this oscillation.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, that'd be interesting to look at. Yeah, thanks.
Following up on Jackson's comment. If you do some phase space averaging, then the distribution might look quite good.
Yes, that's certainly true. Yeah, and someone, yeah, that's right. So I haven't really looked into this, right? But that's certainly true. Like, if you instead define some kind of smeared out distribution, I think that a lot of these oscillations, and again, we'd need to know the period of the oscillations in order to get this, yeah. Right. So, but. Well, okay, I have another approach to the problem that I prefer. Okay, so back to this slide of the challenges, right? We've talked about the approximation for VXC, memory and static correlation, the observable problem, right? And so these are the two big things. So this got us thinking, well, these seem like really difficult problems. Like, how do we dream up functionals that can get these things correct when they're quite unnatural? So he said, well, you know, part of the problem is that, you know, density functional theory reduces everything, you know, very beautifully to a coordinate space density, making the scaling so nice. But can we just include a bit more information in our basic variable, right, and maybe simplify things? So we thought, well, how about a DFT which is based on the phase space density, one body coordinate space, one body probability Vigner space distribution, quasi probability. So the idea again is that the basic variable has more information, so therefore simpler functionals may be more accurate, right? Could we, for example, the momentum is done exactly. I don't need to have a fancy momentum functional to be able to figure out from. I don't have to do the smearing, right, that Karen was suggesting. Okay, more, and the other thing is that more, and which is related actually, so more observables are directly obtained without additional observable functionals. Actually, that's what I was just mentioning. Right? So we looked at this. We have one sort of preliminary paper on it, and we're preparing another one. So this is the phase-based TDDFT. And I'll define these things a bit more. Carefully. So, as I mentioned, the one-body reduced phase Vigner function has this form, where rho 1 is the one-body density matrix, and it contains both R and P information. You take the Vigner function integrator over momentum, you get the coordinate space, and reverse, you get the momentum space distribution, right? Density. Yes.
This may be a silly question.
Oh, no, sorry.
there are also these current density functions. So what's going on?
That's an excellent question. So the current density function, that doesn't have quite as much information as this, because this, the current density, it's true, it gives you some measure of momentum, but it's still averaged. We don't know the distribution of momentum, right? It's J of RT, right? Still kind of coordinate related, you know? I mean, it does, actually J of RT is an integral. It integrates, so you can write the current density as n tilde, so if you take another integral against p here, then you get the current density. So this has more information, right? So it's true, so this is in the spirit of that, but we want to go further. Yeah, thanks. That's a good question.
So in essence, the information in the one-body reduced Wigner function is identical to the information in the one-body density.
Exactly.
What's the nice property of each?
That's very good.
In either one of them?
No, this is a very good point. And actually, we've been thinking. I'm going to motivate shortly why we want to look at the phase space rather than the, and it actually, it turns out that it's with respect to approximations. We want to think. It turns out we're interested in developing. We need to have an approximation for the correlation, right, in this, for the fact. And so what we want to do is we're going to do a quasi-classical approximation where we run classical trajectories and extract the classical correlation and use that in a driving term.
At the very early stage, establish the mathematical property.
Yes, no, mathematically, formally, you're exactly right. These are entirely equivalent.
They are both complex in general?
So this is in fact real. I meant formally as a theory there, equivalent. But yes, they have different mathematical properties. So this is always real. It can be positive or negative. This is Hermitian, the density matrix. So they have different properties, but they contain the same information formally.
So it's always real.
The Wigner function is always real, yes.
That's good enough for motivation.
That's nice. Actually, that's a good point. Yeah, I didn't think about it. Yeah. Okay, so, of course, the Wigner function has been around for a while. Actually, I should have the original reference here. I think it's like 1932 or something. But it's been used mostly for one-particle problems, and especially to make sort of classical quantum analogies, a lot in quantum optics, for example. But some do work on many electron problems, and particularly for transport, and there's actually some review. This is a review article by Jacoboni's group in Italy, and there's also this nice they usually use a one particle description, like sort of the most they've done is Hartree-Fock, right, to include the correlation, and that's this work by Cancellieri and co-workers. But there's also this phase space, Wigner function comes up in this work of this quantum chemist, Peter Gill, who actually doesn't like DFT very much. But anyway, he showed that he comes up with this phase space integral for getting ground state correlation. But again, it's a little different, but he's starting to think he's using these phase space ideas to sort of motivate approaches. Okay, so what are we doing here? Well, we're replacing the basic variable of the density by this phase space density. And firstly, we have to make sure we're allowed to do that. What's the one-to-one mapping, in other words? Well, in principle, because of the Runge-Kruse theorem, then it follows that all observable, because we can obtain from the Wigner function the unique density, then it follows from the Runge-Kruse theorem that the Wigner function also contains all the information about the true system. So this is, so the one-to-one mapping just kind of follows through for these local potentials, right? It's actually also generalizable to vector potentials, which is kind of like John's point, right? With the, because we know with current densities, right, you can do J to A, right? Actually, since W contains the exact current, you can also do W to A, right? So it's a little bit more generalizable. And as Wei pointed out, it's formally equivalent to time-dependent density matrix functional theory, and there's some recent developments in the linear response regime, in particular by Barents' group. But as I was trying to say, I think we're sort of excited to work in the phase space because it turns out that for visualization and approximations and semi-classical kind of analyses, I find it very useful. as we'll see. One thing to point out here is that we've lost the cone-sham system, right? Because if, in other words, we cannot, and in regular TDDFT, what we do is we say, well, let's find a non-interacting system which has the same density as that of the true system. So we might say, well, can we do that? Can we find a non-interacting system which has the same phase space density as the true system? And we cannot. Now, why can we not? Well, it's the same question as asking, can we find a non-interacting system that has the same density matrix, first order density matrix, as the true system? And we cannot because of the idempotency problem. So row one for non-interacting systems always is idempotent. So it has to have eigenvalues 0 or 1. And for the interacting system, it will not be typically idempotent. So we cannot get it, yes.
This problem, Pinkertoff and I talked a little bit.
Sorry, who did?
Pinkertoff and I discussed.
Oh, yes.
I don't believe this is a fundamental limitation in the sense that since you're describing time-dependent process, there is no reason that you should start from a ground state configuration to start with.
Yes.
That's where you get the interpolating problem, right? If you start with a system that is already being shaped,
I see what you're saying.
State.
No, I see what you're saying. Yeah, that's true. So you could start with a non-interacting, you could start with a non-interacting system which is non-idempotent. Yeah, yeah. No, but there the problem is that we want to be able to change the degree of idempotency. So remember that with the electric, the quantum control type problems, we want to be able to change the occupation numbers as a function of time. But if you have a non-interacting system, then your Hamiltonian is always one body. And that means that the rank of the density matrix is always the same, right? So you can't change the idempotency, I don't think.
What if you admit a non-local potential?
Yeah. Yes, then I think you could. Then I think you're right.
And if you derive the control system for such a...
Yes, then it must be non-local. Right.
Most likely your VXC is not real. It has decay. It has imaginary path to handle the decay process.
This might be the case. Might be the case. Yeah. So yes. Okay. So this might be interesting. So I guess I haven't really looked at that. So I'm going to think more about dealing directly with the interacting system, and actually setting up the equations and seeing what we have to model there. But it's a good point. I haven't. Maybe this also opens up another avenue for getting approximations. I get scared of non-local potentials, so, but yeah.
What's known, or what does it matter about the end representability of the figure?
Yeah, so that's a good point. So if you put up the equation of motion shortly. So I'm hiding it all in the initial state, right? Because we still have the initial state dependence here. So if the initial state dependence is n-representable, and we have our basic equation for the Wigner phase space density, right? Then an approximation that we'll need for the correlation part will have to preserve the n-representability feature, right?
But,
well, I mean, it depends on your approximation. So there are approximations actually that people have looked at in the context of nuclear physics for row one, which don't preserve any representability, and then they say, well, we have to stick it back in, and then they have these corrections and so on. I don't want to go there, but I'll show you shortly. Actually, what I'm proposing will not be guaranteed to do the n-representability either, in fact, sadly. Okay, so the other thing about this, as I said a few times now, right, I haven't said this. If you're interested in any one-body operator, so not just position or dipole moments, but, for example, momentum or anything which is one-body, I'm not being very imaginative here, but any one-body operator, then you don't need any observable function, and more observable functions. You can get it directly from W, right, but because it's a one-body. Okay, so here's the equation of motion for W. If you prefer the equation of motion for row one for the density matrix, it is a bit simpler, but it's basically the same structure. You have these terms in the top line. This is the kinetic evolution, external potential. This is often called like a Wigner. This is the Wigner transform, I guess, of the external potential. Anyway, but this, if it was just And this here is the interaction piece. Now, if we look at this, if this piece wasn't there, we're really done, right? Because we just start off with initial state, and then it's, we just propagate. But of course, we're not done. We need an approximation for W2. And So, kinetic energy here is done exactly, unlike in TDDFT, so that's another advantage, right? But now we need some approximation for W2 in terms of W, so we have something closed, and the initial state, right? Okay. So what do we want from these approximations? Well, we want to be able to capture correlation clearly. So if, for example, one can assume something, if you assume the quasi non-interacting particles, then this two-body Wigner function just factorizes as a product of one-body Wigner functions, and you're done. But then that's just kind of like time-dependent Hartree, right? We don't have correlation. We also, as I was saying, we want to change occupation numbers of natural orbitals, do electronic quantum control. And actually, shortly, I'm going to show you a slide on this. What would we do more exactly? Well, you could write down the equation of motion for W2. And you do all this, and you find it depends on W3. And you write the equation of motion for W3, and so on. It depends on W4. So we have this BBGKY hierarchy, which has to be truncated. And people actually have looked at this in the nuclear physics literature more. And they find it gets rapidly messy, especially when you're trying to preserve the trace relations. So I'm going to propose a sort of explore a quasi or semi-classical approach to this term here, which I'll discuss soon. Or maybe I might just let's see, what time is it? Okay, so I will skip this next part. So this next part is just about memory dependence. And it's in that earlier paper here. Okay, so it just argues that with just an example, right, it's not a proof, nothing, but it just gives an example of where, which sort of argues that functionals of the phase space density will have less memory dependence, which will be nicer. But let me now go on to this quasi-classical part here. So here is the equation we just had. And so what we could do first is decompose this two-body term into a product of one-body terms, which would happen if the thing was non-interacting, plus the correction, which comes from exchange correlation effects. Okay, so this is the correction to the two independent particle two-body phase-based distribution, and I'm just calling it W2XC. And so the idea is to obtain this separately. So we run a quasi or semi-classical dynamics of the many-body wave function while evolving all the other terms, which are one-body, exactly, and then obtain that and use that in a driving term here for the quantum equation. Okay, so let me just try and explain a little bit more. So first, for the quasi-classical evolution, it's a bit simpler. What is this? Well, you take your initial quantum state, n-body state, find the initial quantum Wigner distribution, but then you evolve it as a classical phase-space probability distribution. So it's very fast, right? So in other words, you have your initial, and this is many bodies, so this double underline means R1, R2, R3, all the way to n. And you evolve these coordinates. W0 is the initial initial Wigner function for the many-body system, right? And you just basically evolve everything classically backwards from this to get the wave function at time t. Right? And this is classical Liouville, phase-space probability evolution, right? As if it was a classical distribution. And these are the Hamilton's equations you run, right? So classical equations, right? In fact, Rick Heller had sort of developed this mostly, again, for one-body systems, and it was one of the first works while he was thinking about semi-classical methods, actually. So then what we want to do is, from this many-body Wigner function, integrate out all particles but one and get the one-body Wigner function, and also make the product of these, and so therefore calculate this W2XC by integrating all but two particles and subtracting out the product here. And this is what we would then insert into the quantum equation for the W, and as somewhat like a driving term, right? So why would we want to do this? Well, firstly, it to some extent it does capture classical correlation, because the electrons classically are correlated as they run their trajectories, but it does have quantum effects, right? Electrons are quantum mechanical, so better, right? It has quantum effects at the one body level, but this is perhaps an approximation which most naturally has the memory dependence and in particular initial state dependence naturally built in, because you're beginning with this distribution in phase space, it's a quantum distribution, and you then just classically evolve. But it knows then where it came from, and therefore it has this memory dependence in this classical way. It scales with the number of electrons in a classical way, right, like molecular dynamics almost. But as Kieran raised the question of n-representability, there's no guarantee for n-representability. I don't really know how much of a problem this will be. But here's another question. Well, can this such a simple approximation, can it still change occupation numbers of natural orbitals? So this is one of the main motivating factors for the phase-based DFT. And again, what we mean by natural orbitals, we take the row 1 and we diagonalize it. These are the natural orbital occupation numbers. So for example, in the electronic quantum control problem of helium before, when it went from 1s2 to 1s2p, then F1 is going from 2, if it was really just the state, is going from 2 to 1, but of course there's a little bit of correlation, so it's near 2 to near 1, while F2 is going from near 0 to near 1, right? So these have to change. And in fact, this method does. And how do we know this? We ran it on a very, very simple but very terrible model of an atom, the Mushinsky atom, which is this really awful model because the interaction grows as you pull the electrons apart. But on the other hand, it's very, very nice because it means that people like me who don't like running hard numerical calculations don't have to, because everything's harmonic. So you can do a lot of things analytically or semi-analytically, right? So you can solve for the wave function easily by separating into center of mass and relative coordinates, and therefore obtain the exact occupation numbers to compare with. In fact, what we did was we did this, and we drove with driving for the harmonic well to encourage population transfer. Now, this is like a transition frequency of the unperturbed system, and this is what we got. This is the occupation number as a function of time. There are oscillations which are going along with K of T, and it's a very simple run, right? We're not even doing control or anything. We just decided to run it. But you can see the occupation numbers are changing, right? In fact, we're approaching that state which is the center of mass coordinate W. Excitation to the center of mass coordinate, essentially. And in fact, if we ran the quasi-classical calculation and we ran the exact calculation, they would lie exactly on top of each other, because quasi-classical Wigner evolution is exact for all harmonic quadratic interactions. So this means that in principle, this method will be able to change occupation numbers. Okay, all right. And I'll skip this part. If we want to go back beyond that, right? So quasi-classical Wigner, by the way, if it was quasi-classical, we get the evolution at time t to zeroth order in h-bar, right? It's a classical evolution, right? But if we want to go one step further, we can get it to order h-bar by using frozen Gaussians or semi-classical evolution. But I think I should probably skip this. It's a bit more complicated, but it has interference in phase, and that's okay. And so here's kind of a summary so far. And I can stop here, or I can say a little bit more. Stop, okay. All right, so... So approximate TDDFT, although remarkably successful for many wide-ranging applications, faces serious pitfalls for several applications in real-time dynamics. It's particular when the true wave function is dominated equally by more than one slated determinant, when memory dependence is important, when the observable interest is not directly related to the density. Phase-based TDDFT could be more successful in these cases, ameliorating all three problems. Two-body Wigner functionals are needed that dynamically change occupation numbers, and the quasi or semi-classical treatment of the dynamics of the correlation part may be a promising route, naturally including initial state dependence in memory, and we should further explore this. So this was this part, which was completely different. So I'll just, if you're interested, I can talk about this. Yes, I will. I'm just trying to get to my acknowledgments. So these are the people who worked on the space. This is our group at Hunter. And, well, this is irrelevant because we didn't get to it. So thanks for listening, and I thank my funders. Okay.
So this result that you mentioned, that pigment propagation is exactly harmonic.
Yes.
Could you give us some insight into that?
Yeah.
I'd like you to be to other.
Right. No, that's actually, so actually this, so this, in I, well, let me see, sorry. Okay, so. Yeah, so actually it turns out that when you have classical dynamics, right, then, well, okay. Actually, maybe I can explain different with the, okay. So the true wave function, right, we, with Feynman's theorem, I have to, you know, go back and check a good explanation for this. Oops. But maybe for now, I can try it with this. Okay, so the Feynman result with path integrals says that, you know, that you have the true wave function is the sum over all paths of e to the I action, classical action over h bar, even classical action over the funny path, right, non-classical path. Okay, and if you do this when you're going between two paths, right, you find that the action between neighboring paths cancels out, right? So largely cancels out, so that sort of to first order, you get paths which have delta s equals zero. So maybe, so then this is exactly the classical relation, right? This delta s being zero means that the change of the classical action is zero, and this defines the classical path. But you do a bit more than that. So you then write s classical as equal to, s classical here along, is equal to s, my notation is funny here. So let me write S for some path, right, is equal to the classical path, plus then we do a Taylor expansion, right, delta S around that path, plus del squared S around that path, plus so on, right? And this, as we just said, around the classical paths is zero. So we have this, and then we have del squared S, which is, which is basically the second derivative of the action, and then it's times x. If you change it into a path integral, you can see that there'll be a quadratic term in the path variable. Okay, so where is this driving to? Well, turns out if you have quadratic interactions, the Taylor series stops here. There's nothing beyond this because everything's quadratic, so del cubed s is always zero. So therefore, this thing here is exact. And what I've explained more is why the semi-classics is exact, because that's what semi-classics does. And I think for the Wigner, right, for the quasi-classical Wigner, I need to study a bit more of what the exact argument is, but I think it's also based on argument with the quadratic Hamiltonians. The distribution evolves like in this way too. I should check that a bit more. Yeah.
What I'm getting at is it a very delicate fluke that's going to completely fall apart when you go to a system that's in the slightest?
Yeah. Especially when things are singular, it will fall apart. So that is certainly true. I think it'll work okay as long as you're relatively smooth, so maybe locally quadratic, it'll be okay. But you know, the Coulomb singularity might mess up, right? Of course. But so this is a problem. However, our method's not treating everything quasi-classically. So a large part of it is quantum mechanical through the one-body terms, and then we're using this as a sort of classical correlation piece, right? Is it some way of getting some correlation which is some a little bit physical because you've got it's classical, and then you're putting it in. So that's the motivation there.
I mean, when you say it falls apart, but I mean, it's still a
very good semi-classical method, right? It's just the exactness that falls apart.
Yeah, right.
To the extent that semi-classical dynamics.
Or quasi-classical, yes, no, that's right, yes. And actually that also touches on this, the problem of the scaling. Because, well, for the quasi-classical dynamics where we don't have the phases, the scaling to get the particle trajectories and the convergence of the integrals and so on, that goes relatively, that will scale like the square root of n. It's like a Monte Carlo type thing, because the distribution, as long as the initial distribution's not negative, is positive. But actually if we do the semi-classical, then for more than a few degrees of freedom, this rapidly oscillating phase, which has the interference in there, messes that up, the scaling. So that's another problem with this.
I have a question about your classical propagation. You showed this with a V, an external V, and a Coulomb V.
Yes.
Is there might be a more consistent choice with a sort of cone and channel type of thing. I guess not, because you're doing this to model the interacting.
Yes. Right, exactly. Unless we do something with these non-local, like mapping to the Kohn-Sham system with the non-local potential, maybe there, something. But I mean, within this, I'm trying to just focus on the interacting system.
Yeah. So, if you look at the part that you are treating fully quantum mechanics,
yeah,
in the Digma evolution,
yeah,
does that already contain some parts of what we normally think of as exchange and correlation?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So actually, no, it doesn't. And so here's a couple of things. So actually, it doesn't, because I think to write W2 as this product is assuming that they're independent particles, so that they, I don't think that has any many body exchange correlation in there. One other thing is that actually, if instead you did this type of thing with rho one, so instead of W, and of course formally it's all equivalent, but then if you had rho one, you could actually write the rho two here as rho one minus rho one, and include the exchange. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, with the permutations, and you can include the exchange there within this term here, and just have the correlation part approximated. We can't do this with the Wigner functions because of the way it mixes up the R's and P's when it does that. I mean, well, yeah, you can. I tried, but I couldn't do it.
Well, I was wondering whether the difference between T and TS might be somehow in that first term.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. So actually, the T is done exactly here. I think you're right. I didn't explain this properly. So this is the kinetic energy, in fact, is done exactly. So that's right. It has the kinetic correlation in there. It's just the exchange correlation. It just doesn't have the potential correlation part. Yes, you're right, yeah. Yeah, wait.
So the real reason that you get a really nice result, even with a very crude approximation, it's because you plug your two-particle Wigner function into a one-particle Wigner function equation motion. Right? So you generate one more line of interaction.
Right.
Why, if you have non-interacting W times W,
yes,
it becomes Hartree-Young.
Exactly.
Actually, you can write this whole thing diagrammatically. You can see this is basically you're relating G2 to G1.
Yeah.
And of course, that's just density matrix, and you just do a Fourier from the density matrix. So they're really related.
Yes, absolutely.
So,
yeah.
Which means that if you do any kind of semi-classical expansion like what you're doing here, the quality is really controlled by, of course, once you do expansion to high order, it becomes better, right? But at the level of what you're doing now, you don't introduce the next order.
Yeah.
The quality is entirely controlled by how you truncate your equation of motion. In other words, if you truncate at the three-body level, you start integrating to a two-body equation of motion. From there, you get a one-body equation.
Oh, I see what you mean.
One over order in the perturbation sense.
Right.
So
yeah.
I suspect that once you put the delta S there, mm-hmm. you will be equivalent of saying that you just do exactly the semi-classical approach.
But
that was a three-body.
I see. Oh, that's actually very interesting.
I think there is an order by order argument that is exactly in the perturbation theory and in the expansion. If you write down the order of H bar, I think they are equivalent.
Is that right? Let me think. It seems kind of right. But on the other hand, let me see. I'm not sure. They seem very different approximations, because when I truncate, so this is an H-bar type of argument, right? Whereas when the truncation is more of an independent particle type of argument. Right?
Truncation here is basically the truncation of order of interaction.
Yeah, but this is not just interaction here. The H-bar is affecting the whole evolution, right? Even if we had non-interacting, but this is the whole classical action.
Yeah. I'm thinking that in the expansion, if you write down everything, there is also H-bar there, which means that the order of interaction and the order of H-bar.
It might be interesting. Yeah. I see.
So the success of this is basically the mirror that the classical past or the past integral is representative already. Uh-huh. Need to just smear them out. Right?
So the sort of assumption is that at least to some degree the electron correlation is classical, right? To some extent the correlation between electrons can be described in a classical way. I mean, they repel each other.
For the reading correlated system, that probably won't hold. Right? The real correlated system, the classical past.
Yeah.
The representative. They smear out so much.
Yeah. So then the question is, and for the really correlated systems, there the occupation numbers really become, right, very far from.
Classical analog.
So then I guess the question is, can this capture those?
The problem is that then you have to worry about, can you live with a finite truncation H-bar, for example, right? Mm-hmm. Actually, I had the same question for Kieran, because you have this idea of expansion with respect to H-bar, right? Basically using the semi-classical. I haven't thought about this carefully, but I suspect that eventually corresponds to some low-order perturbation theory, many-body perturbation theory, which means that for a really strongly correlated system, you would deviate so much from the semi-classical limit, that approach wouldn't work. In other words, I'm trying to say something about what is the right when he's talking about the coffee, right? You claim there's one right way to do the. I'm not so sure that statement is. It's the same reason here.
Well, the thing about these semi-classical type approximations, one thing is that this expansion, I mean, it's an essential singularity here. It's an asymptotic type of expansion, so not really the typical sort of perturbative expansion. You get these funny things happening as a result of the asymptotic expansion, and actually some of the discussion on the quasi-classical propagation and for what potentials is exact and not exact, it really hinges on the corrections, which naively look like they're order H-bar, but because of this thing here, you pull down other H-bars that cancel and they become order zero and stuff like this. Anyway, I think it may be a bit more subtle than that.
That would be interesting to figure out.
Yeah.
One more comment. Now, of course, we realize that this is nothing but density matrix in a different basis.
Yes, exactly.
But of course, it's nice to have a Wiener function because it has a classical analog.
Yes, right. I mean, and this is why this is motivating our approximation here.
But on the other hand, that's precisely that you don't have the phase information built in some sense, right? But it's hidden in entity only, right?
Well, yeah, so that's true for the quasi-classical level, not for the semi-classical. So if you do this to order H-bars, if you do this to the semi-classical thing, then you do have interference, you have tunneling, you have everything.
Right. Yeah, so what I want to say is that is really true that this will be easier in the sense that if I were following Rick's earlier question, you can see that with density matrix, you can build into Hartree-Fock immediately at this level.
Right.
But you cannot do that with exchange because you need a phase there, right?
Right. I mean, you're saying you can't do this with the phase space, right? Because I can't, mostly just simply because, more simply, I can't break up the product to account for exchange, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so, but the thing is, then there's, I mean, yeah, so we can't get the Hartree-Fock, but I don't know how important it is. I mean, so in other words, I don't know, to separate exchange and correlation, right? I mean, how important is, I mean, in some sense, they're manifestations of the one thing. So I'm, you know, there's, you know, the from ground state, there's all these canceling effects that happen between exchange and correlation that are, that make LDA work as well as it does, for example, right? So I'm not sure whether I really want to do build in correlation separately from exchange. I might want to treat them together. I mean, you know, to build in this error cancellation, perhaps. So I don't know. Maybe some applications this will be useful. Some other applications would be better to separate the exchange. Well, it depends on which chemist. If you talk to Everett, no, but it depends on which chemist. If you talk to Everett Jan Barents, he'll say, don't separate exchange and correlation. Treat them as one, right?
The most advantage here is that you can now do a semi-classical or quasi-classical expansion, and that's really the key. The question, I guess, then is, can you think about the same semi-classical or quasi-classical approximation for density matrix?
Uh-huh. Yes, I mean, you can. I mean, well, I think ultimately, of course, what we're doing here can be written in density matrix language. And actually, that's when I started, because at the beginning I did want to separate exchange, and I didn't want to.
In terms of the expansion in terms of the.
What I would end up doing, what I would write, because when you do the quasi classics, you need to have when you do any classical trajectories, you need to know the momentum and the position. So I'd end up translating it at this next page, right, in terms of. At this next page, I'd. You know, you start off with row one, but then you'd do a free transform to get the W. So you'd kind of do it through the W ultimately, and then building back.
In fact, what's really exciting about this is that your conclusion can be transferred into the density matrix approach too.
Yeah, yeah,
exactly. Instead of thinking about perturbation series of the density matrix.
Well, it was sort of maybe it's related to what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think when the momentum variable is really important. I mean, the case you started with was where you really had a particle with
ionizing
going along.
Yeah.
And there it's sensible.
Right.
But in many problems, I don't really see the need for a Wigner type representation. And the question is representation, when it's appropriate and when not. So the question is, when do you really see this Wigner representation as being
important?
The right one?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good question. Actually, because in fact, even in ground state DFT, people have looked at Wigner functions in the cone sham and true, and they make exactly your point that actually, even though in principle they're supposed to be different, they're not that different, right? The momentum distribution is, you know, you can get Compton scattering things and so on. But I think in a fully time-dependent case, when you do have electrons kind of buzzing around doing different things, then I think it would be typical that the, I don't know, but yeah. Yeah, right. Making the dynamics kind of. Okay. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, thanks.
I have one question. If you imagine a system and you're doing time dependent DFT,
mm-hmm.
and also you do it this way, there must be some kind of Sham-Schroeder type equation relating the exact time-dependent Cohen-Sham potential to some of these objects, right? You just imagine that you're doing the Wigner phase space evolution, and the other is.
It's a TDDFT.
Yeah, there'll be some integral equation that two sides must match.
Right. Like in the. I mean, in the same spirit as these conserving approximations are being developed, right?
And,
and now we.
Look at that to not necessarily make direct approximations, but to try to see what might correspond. What, and also.
That'd be interesting.
Might give ideas about this classical evolution.
Right. Yeah, no, that would be interesting. I hadn't thought about that at all. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Yeah.
I guess it's 10 minutes to 12. I'll still ask people for the formal stuff. But, how many people want to meet the formal stuff? Or
oh, they could go if you can go if you want.
Is it formal stuff?
Yeah, this is the. It starts from the Monty Python. Very formal. Okay, so, is there, okay, thanks. Okay, great, thank you, yeah. So this is very different. So revisiting the formal theorems behind TDEFT, right? So it turns out that there's a bunch of time analyticity requirements that are involved in the Runge-Gross theorem and also the existence of the Cohn-Sham theorem, the Van Leeuwen theorem. So and this is the Runge-Gross theorem, right? One-to-one mapping between density and potential for a certain initial state, but it's proven only for potentials which are analytic in time about the initial time, T0. In other words, when potentials which are equal to their Taylor series expansion in time for a fixed R, for a fixed position, right? Then there's also the Van Leeuwen theorem, which says, you know, well, okay, this is the existence of the mapping, and then the Van Leeuwen theorem is that, well, then now you can take this density and look for a Cohn-Sham system which reproduces this density, right? So it's the V representability under different interparticle interactions. In other words, it shows that if you have a system here with VEE, some potential V, it's evolving in the density, that you can reproduce the same density in a system with a different interparticle interaction, and a different, and this V tilde exists, this other potential exists, in a particular Cohn-Sham V tilde 0, V tilde is, and V tilde, sorry, VEE tilde is 0, and V tilde is the Cohn-Sham potential. And this requires that the proof requires that both the density and the potential are time analytic, right? So the Runge-Gross issue requires that the potential has to be time analytic. The Van Leeuwen theorem, if you look at the proof, it also expands the density in a Taylor series, and it's proven only for both density and potential to be time analytic. So how restrictive are these requirements first? Well, it means that potentials that turn on like e to the minus c over t to the n, which is not time analytic, or t to the p where p is non-integer, or t to the n log t, that they're not actually covered in the Runge-Gross theorem. So can we extend Runge-Gross to apply to such potential? And in fact, Van Leeuwen did. And for linear response from the ground state, he showed you can. But that, again, it's just for linear response from the ground state. And he said that you can the Runge-Gross mapping will hold for any Laplace transformable in time potential. Right? It's a different, much wider class. But then we might say, well, what happens if I want to do real-time dynamics, nonlinear response, and also if I want to do a response from a non-ground state? We don't know, right? There's no proof yet. So then we might ask, well, okay, this looks hard. Let's accept the restriction to V being time analytic. Is it then reasonable to assume that the density is also time analytic, as is required for the Van Leeuwen V representability theorem? In fact, as I'm going to show you by some very simple examples, no. Turns out that if you have spatial non-analyticities, and these could be smooth behaviors, but cusps or cusps, right? But it could be smooth. Then you can get time non-analyticity through the Schrödinger equation, even for the most innocently evolving potentials. What the implication of this is that it would mean that the V representability proof would fall through. In other words, we wouldn't know the existence, whether the existence and Cohn-Sham of the existence and uniqueness of the Cohn-Sham system exists, holds, right? So here's some, here's one example which sort of illustrates this. It's from one of my kids' favorite books, The Desapparated Nucleus. If you've seen Harry Potter, you'll know what desapparated means. But you basically have, you can think of electron in the hydrogen atom and sitting there on this nucleus and then suddenly removing the nucleus. Or you can just think of an electron with a cusp, you know, the initial density evolving in free space. Okay, so we're going to propagate this wave function here using this free particle propagator. And if you do this, you can actually, Mathematica can do it for you. And you get this wave function here, square root of t's. So it's very non-analytic. I mean, so I shouldn't say very. It's non-analytic in time. And actually, it's completely different from its Taylor series. If you fix x instead and you, you know, take a Taylor series of the wave function, so you just compute the Taylor coefficients of psi, in other words, d psi dt, d2 psi dt squared, and so on, what you get, and let's look away from x equals 0 for a minute, what you get first is simply the initial wave function with this very trivial time evolution, right? So it's just this wave function, basically not evolving, right? So it's very different. It's not time analytic. Okay, let's look at how it looks in space, right? This is a picture of how it looks. Time equals 0, you have a cusp. Immediately after time equals 0, the cusp vanishes. The wave function disperses. Oscillations begin to develop in the tail. And notice the scale is decreasing from 0.9 to 0.3, right? If you look at the Taylor series solution, and if I plotted the density, this term goes away, the density does nothing. So the density of the Taylor series remains this. A totally different solution, right? But is it a solution? Well, let's see. I mean, although the Taylor series actually solves the free particle Schrödinger equation away from x equals 0, at x equals 0, it yields a delta function error. Okay, so it's not actually a solution to the Schrödinger equation. The delta function is a huge thing, so it's not an error. And also, I just want to point out that it's not to do with being in 1D and having a cusp. If you instead look in 3D with a minus, looking e to the minus r wave function, you also get the same, exactly the same analysis holds. Okay. So, oops, sorry, my PowerPoint went funny here, so I'll just put everything here. Okay, so you might think, well, that's a cusp, so, you know, derivative discontinuity, you know, it's not surprising that it doesn't work. But actually, you can get non-analytic densities typically in other examples, even when the initial wave function and potential are spatially smooth. So if you evolve a bump state, so this is something like e to the minus cx squared minus x0 squared, right? X squared minus 1 squared in the denominator there and the exponent. You get this wave function, which is, you know, it has compact support, meaning it's strictly 0 here at 1, but it's infinitely differentiable, absolutely smooth. And it turns out that if you try to evolve this state in free space, you find that the true solution will disperse. But if you look at the Taylor series solution, it doesn't disperse. It just stays like this. Nothing happens out here in the Taylor series. Or if you like, instead, you have if you turn on some potential like a ramp here, which is again zero here, but then it turns on absolutely smoothly, infinitely differentiable, and you start off with some wave function, then you might think, well, the density should, you know, spill over into this region. But if you look at the Taylor series out here for Schrödinger's equation, absolutely nothing happens. So again, the Taylor series is wrong. So the upshot is that even if the potential is time analytic, the Runge-Gross theorem holds, right? Because as in these examples, right? But that often, right, a time analytic potential does lead to densities which are not time analytic. And for those situations, then, the existence and uniqueness of the Cohen-Sham system is not yet proven. And so what we've been actually looking at with a mathematician is, can we prove these TDDFT theorems without assuming T time analysis? And we should be submitting a preprint soon on the archive. I'll put it up, but it's really hard. And so here's our mathematician, and he's actually not an analyst, so that makes it harder. But he's been looking through the math literature and translating everything for us, and he's figured out a lot about the equations and mapped it onto a nonlinear Schrödinger equation, basically that needs to be analyzed. But this kind of analysis has not been done for this kind of equation, so it sort of opens up a question, but we don't have the answer. Okay, and that's it. Thanks. Yeah.
let me just ask follow up. So in this formal thing, you're trying to make the case that the existence of the Tang Xiang system might be questionable for a time-dependent case.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess the point is that since the Schrödinger equation links time and space, right, then, and so even if we let ourselves have a time-analytic density, so time-analytic potential, then Runge-Gross will hold, but then the question is, well, can we also assume a time-analytic density, because we need that for the existence of Cohen-Chang. But another thing is that, I mean, the proof actually that we've been, the mathematical type of approach to this problem doesn't assume anything about Taylor series. So it's sort of, you know, it starts from a different, maybe we have different problems there, so do Picard iterations converge for these partial differential equations and so on, but it's never anywhere mentioned analytic properties. So even if we could make something work in that direction, then it's a completely different approach, which won't even have any time analytic requirement, and even in the Runge-Gross theorem.
Now, this reminds me that what Kieran just asked, right? In the TPQT framework,
yeah,
one can try to match the equation motion of a quote-unquote Tang Xiang system that you arbitrarily built versus the two density matrix of the, or the density of the two main body system. By that matching, you can artificially create this Tang Xiang system, right? But of course, then this question is mapped to the, I think it's mapped to the problem that when you do this, you always wind up having a K Tang Xiang inverse. Which I believe that Wolf has touched a little bit on. There's a non-uniqueness of that inversion. So this issue might be related to
Right, with the response functions.
Not even with the response functions, just VXC itself, right? If you try to define VXC using that kind of construction.
Right, you still have a chi. Yeah. No, that's a good point. Yeah.
Okay.